So today I have the great pleasure of welcoming back for the, I don't know how what how many times she's spoken here before.
Three or four
at least. Yosho Virginia Matthews, our dear friend, and she has spoken on a variety of topics, and it's my understanding that our Many Rivers staff has solicited a talk on this particular subject. So all hail the staff in this case, because this is a subject I have wanted to hear you speak on myself as well. So thank you so much for coming tonight, and welcome to Many Rivers.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Amba, for encouraging me, in fact, to say, I want you to come speak about relationship. And I went, I don't know. I'm not an expert on relationship. And I said, let me think about it. And what I realized was I was passionately interested in relationship. I am been in a life partnership for 44 years, come May 16th. And my teacher, Sasaki Roshi, has always honored relationship and used it as part of his teaching. So I felt like this is something that I have been very involved with. But I do want to say that I don't come here in any way as an expert or authority, and that really what I wanted to do was put attention and awareness to this this life partnership creation that is happening for many people. And what I wanted to do actually is start with a survey.
That's sociological
of you. Yeah. Because I think it's just a show of hands is fine. So how many people here are currently committed to a life partnership?
My cat. Does that count?
No, to a human being. Okay. How many of you have experienced the dissolution of a life partnership? How many of you are searching for or desiring, wanting a life partnership in your life? And how many of you are clear at this point in your life that this is not the path for you, a life partnership? Interesting. I thought there'd be one or two people. So this is something that affects us all in our life. And I thought I would just start with a look at what would be traditionally a life partnership up until these times, which is a marriage between a man and a woman. And that was a marriage that was not necessarily based on equality and choice. I think if we look back over the ages, we see this is a fairly recent development, particularly choice, or particularly equality, and then choice. Marriage has been often an arrangement between tribes, within tribes, that extended to families, making arrangements with families. Maybe land holdings needed to be consolidated. Economic reasons, farmers who needed the labor of two people, and then, of course, the children that came. So marriage certainly had a different timbre in, I would say, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but in my readings, it seems pretty much up until the 18th, 19th century, where perhaps there was more choice. But choice was limited to one's often geographical and economic milieu. People did not cross boundaries that much. People did not travel to distant places and meet other people. They didn't cross economic boundaries. People often had what we call arranged marriages. My favorite sort of look at that is the musical Fiddler on the Roof. You're aware of that. It's a particular milieu that I'm familiar with. My grandparents came from that part of Russia. They were not brought together as a matchmaker. Do you remember that song? Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Actually, that play encapsulates the progression of what happened around the turn of the century, where you were expected to be married through a yenta, a matchmaker. And that was just definitely, that's the way it went. And yet, poor Tevye's daughter had fallen in love. Now, this is kind of a new concept in those days, fallen in love with this young man in his village and refused the, or begged her father that she would be miserable for the rest of her life if she married her to this 60-year-old widower, which could have been possibly true. And somehow, okay, he weasels out of that. And then the next daughter chooses someone, a foreigner, someone who comes into the village, not even part of their village. And that was very hard to swallow. And the third daughter marries outside of the faith. And so to me, it was a wonderful encapsulating of this progression of what was happening to marriage in the 19th century, what's been happening to this idea of union that transcends the small family. My grandparents met in their village. My grandfather was at the wedding of his brother and married the sister of the bride. I mean, this was pretty close. And so they, and yet their children here in America, there were no yentas, there were no matchmakers, there was a little wider field. All of them chose people through the Jewish faith, except my uncle, who went all the way to Australia in the war and married someone from a Catholic Australian. So here was the first time in this little family lineage that marriage had expanded beyond the family tribal faith. In those days, we didn't ask if this was a successful marriage. My parents' generation. I'm looking at the marriages in my family. We didn't go around saying, so and so is having, they have a very happy and successful marriage, or they're really having an unhappy marriage. It just seemed a given that they were married, they were committed, they were going to go through this. Divorce did not seem to be an option. Some of them worked through their very difficult circumstances, and some didn't. But they all did end their lives married. And they did take seriously, or it culturally, it happened that the vows of till death do us part was their reality. I have given marriage, I've married three people now, and so we've gone through the vows, three couples, we've gone through the vows, and it's interesting how people shy away a little bit from the traditional vows these days. But I think it would be interesting to look at and to hear them again. These are vows, I assume, came through the Christian tradition. I don't think they are in the Jewish. It seems to have pervaded our culture. So, and this is interesting. So, blank. I blank take you blank to be my lawful wedded spouse, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish as long as we both shall live. I thought it was interesting that in all, when I looked through the traditional vows, that as long as we both shall live has been substituted. Originally it was till death do us part. Mm-hmm. But I figure our culture is a little death phobic. So they substituted this. This was my niece and her husband who did decide to have the traditional vows. Here too. Okay, so we followed the lineage of my grandparents, and they had their very circumscribed community, and then their parents, their children got to go a little bit, and then my brother and I both married outside of the Jewish faith, since we weren't brought up in the Jewish faith to begin with, it didn't seem important. And then my niece, my brother's daughter, married an Afro-American Mormon from Utah.
<Whoa. laughs>
So you can see this progression of how people are choosing life partners from this enormously wider pool. Just today or yesterday, I was talking to some of my Pilates students, whose son, who works in London, and met a Lebanese woman. So he's there, and they're going to get married. So they're already talking about the three different marriage ceremonies that are going to have to take place. One in Lebanon, one in London, and one in Sebastopol. Same thing when I was visiting my cousin, who's still part of this lineage. His daughter married an Iranian Muslim, an Iranian Muslim. And they too had two ceremonies. So the field is just pooling out there and expanding. And one can't help think of what is the culture, what is the community that's holding the fabric of these two people. It's quite spread. It's quite wide. Is it American culture's idea of marriage? Is it the Islamic idea of marriage? Is it what is the expectations of these two people in this idea of a life partnership? These are just questions I'm throwing out because I don't have any answers. All I know is that young people today, and I have three young men, who are rather terrified of the success rate of partnerships and commitment. I mean, I hear from them all the time. I'm so afraid that I really want to commit, but 50% of all partnerships end in divorce is the statistic. So that's what they hear. And they say, and they ask me, I'm their mom. Okay, so how did you stay married? How did you commit and stay? And how did you know that this was the person that you could walk this journey in life together all the way to the end? And I said, I can only share my experience, which was meeting my partner at age 16. And in one night, feeling that I had come home, that I had found someone that I could rest in, that I could come home and feel seen, trusted, loved, whatever. It was pure instinct, just pure instinct. And I made the commitment that night that this was the person I was going to walk my life's journey with. It's been very difficult. It's been incredibly joyous. It's been incredibly painful. It's been incredibly rewarding. I would like to share the vow that we, or the readings that we had at our marriage. We, of course, this is 1971, the hippie movement, you know, first of all, getting married in a church was kind of a compromise, but it was a Unitarian church. We had this idea of the vows did not sit well with us. We felt like we had made our commitment, but we weren't going to get into this, you know, to have and to hold. So at the time, this was rather, not unknown as a marriage. Now it's very, very common. It's the on marriage from Cahil Gibran. Do we all know that? Mm-hmm. I'd like to read it. He's asking to talk of marriage, and he answers saying, "You were born together, and together you shall be forevermore. You shall be together when the white wings of death scatter your days. Aye, you shall be together even in the silent memory of God. But let there be spaces in your togetherness, and let the winds of the heavens dance between you. Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your souls. Fill each other's cup, but drink not from one cup. Give one another of our bread, but eat not from the same loaf. Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each one of you be alone. Even as the strings of a lute are alone, though they quiver with the same music. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping, for only the hand of life can contain your hearts. And stand together, yet not too near together, for the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow." I think what spoke to me and Jim at the time was that, yes, we were going to walk this journey together, but we couldn't do it in the idea of leaning on each other or dependent on each other, that we had to develop ourselves on this journey and stand alone. Sometimes I do wonder that the wind, what is it? That the winds of the heavens dance between you. That there have been times on our journey that the winds of the heaven danced so far between us that we were a little lost to each other. And the spaces in our togetherness sometimes got very wide apart. So it is a dance. And as a dancer, I thought I understood it, but it was the journey and the experience over and over again of, well, how far are we going to go apart? How far does this go before we're not even on the same road anymore? Helen Luke, a Jungian psychologist, talks about that the real purpose of these life partnerships is growth. And when the growing stops, then perhaps it is time for a dissolution. And she talked about a very beautiful ceremony, or not even a ceremony, just a ritual that happened in northern Scotland, I believe, when two people came to the realization that their walking the road together was no longer contributing to the growth, that the relationship had died, in a sense, till death do us part. Perhaps it's the death of the relationship, that they would go to the church that they've been married in, and they would walk in together the door. They'd stand at the altar, just stand there, not say anything, and then walk out separate entrances. And in that sense, they were honoring the sacrament of the marriage, but saying, this has died, and we will be going our separate ways. I did come across something very similar from a woman who says she's an expert in relationships. Perhaps we should have her here. That I thought was the most important thing I try to teach people is that the purpose of a relationship, and she's talking about life relationships, is not to make you feel good or even to make you happy. It's to help you grow and bring you closer to spirit, God, all that is. And she goes on to say, I believe that a lifelong intimate relationship with another person is a profound opportunity for you to recognize all that is unloving in you and to replace it with everything that's loving. And I remember, I'll get to that. In my next session. So when I was thinking about the life partnership, I actually realized that the Indian model of the stages of life has some correlations with the life of a relationship. Though the first one, the physical attraction, romantic love, falling in love, stage one. In that case, in the there's not a great emphasis on that in the Indian philosophy, because the East sees marriage a little bit differently. The West has a huge cultural literature and stories, and just think about all that is out there about romantic love. I mean, our movies and our novels and our stories, and it all apparently comes from the Middle Ages with the idea of the chivalry, where you fell in love with someone who was unattainable because they were married, and marriage wasn't about love. You fell in love, but it was also could be an allegory for spirit. So I find it the obsession of our culture with romantic love is already just a huge stress on this relationship. So everyone, I think, who enters into a relationship has to deal with that, has to bring awareness to what are these expectations that have been fed to me since I was this high, whether it was the fairy tales or the movies that we saw. What is this about? And then nowadays we even have this escalation of obsession with marriages in our media now, with suddenly it becomes a success or failure. I mean, we're just so happy apparently to see the failure of celebrities' marriages. You know, this is, and the mean-spiritedness of it. And so here, you know, it just keeps coming on to this poor beginning where you're just trying to find each other, find each other's ground here. So if you kind of can get through that, then you get into householder life, which is a stage where you are actively in the world. You're creating, and it could be simply even building a house or getting a house, and or taking responsibility for pets or having children. Just walking this stage together in creating, in creation of householder life. Then if you get through that with all of the pressures of distraction, time, then you get to go to forest dweller stage. Okay, so householder life is calming down. Maybe you're not as involved in careers, children, maybe things are getting quieter. Maybe you start to look at your partner and rediscover them. You get to withdraw, not completely, and enter the forest dweller stage. And the last stage, which I call the Buddhist terms of old age, sickness, and death, would be the renunciant stage, in where you are finished and you are getting closer to God, to spirit. So, in these stages of life partnership, where does spiritual practice come in? I'm assuming that everyone here is interested in some form of a relationship with spirit, a spiritual practice. Does this model of life partnership, does it help us cultivate the quality of spiritual practice? Does our commitment to spiritual practice support life relationships? Is it an either or? Is it the chicken, the horse before the cart before the horse, the chicken before the egg, whatever that is? What are some of the well, first of all, I came up for me with the base of spiritual practice for me was making the commitment, the devotion, and surrender. And through that base, cultivating qualities of trust, faith, truth, forgiveness, kindness, gratitude, and appreciation, non-judgment. These are things that come through my practice. I know for myself, I didn't actually see so well how my spiritual practice could cultivate these qualities in a life partnership, or vice versa. They remained rather separate for me. I have a lovely another reading that I thought, which I didn't discover till I started searching readings. It's the Rilke passage, if some of you know that. For one human being to love another human being, that is perhaps the most difficult task that has been entrusted to us. The ultimate task, the final test and proof, the work for which all other work is merely preparation. Loving does not at first mean merging, surrendering, and uniting with another person. It is a high inducement for the individual to ripen, to become something in himself, herself, to become world, to become world in himself for the sake of another person. It is a great demanding claim on her, something that chooses her and calls her to vast distance. Once the realization is accepted that even between the closest people, infinite distances exist, a marvelous living side by side can grow up for them. If they succeed in loving the expanse between them, which gives them the possibility of seeing each other as a whole and before an immense sky. I think that quality of seeing the other person as whole and against an immense sky was something that only has come to me recently. 44 years. And perhaps that is the walking of this road together, that you can't start from that place. Some people in psychology terms feel that you are a mirror to each other. You're rubbing the two stones, rubbing against each other, rubbing away the veneer, rubbing away the egoic self-centeredness, till you can get to that place where you can see. I know when it happened to me, and it was only a few years. I think it was when my third son was born. I was in labor, but we were encouraged to go out to eat. I was in early labor, and Jim and I went to a Chinese restaurant, and we had finished dinner, and Jim went to the other side of the room, and he was paying for the dinner, and I suddenly saw, oh my gosh, this person has been here with me for all these years, and I have never seen him whole and against an immense God. And that was the beginning of my being able to hold that we had done enough, maybe rubbing and scraping and mirroring and pushing each other's buttons, till I could get to that place of, it was immense gratitude, an immense appreciation. And I think that's when my two spiritual practice life partnership really joined. Now, I'm sure it happens, hopefully happens for people at different times in their partnership. I was particularly interested in, when I was doing a little research for this, to read this book called Grace and Grit. Because this was, have people read this? This is a life partnership that lasted only 5 years, and yet they went the entire gamut, and thoroughly and completely. And they were both totally committed to this, the relationship as their spiritual practice. And I found it really illuminating that all those stages were so articulated. That stage of I should read Treya's words, because I think she says it really well. And she was actually responding to Dafri John, and she says, I like what Dafri John says in this book about relationship, about the ego is nothing but the contraction or avoidance of true relationship. I certainly recognize in myself when he describes the ego as reactive and contracting away from relationship. I recognize myself as often feeling rejected and thus engaging in the egoic ritual of defending myself against what I see as insults, hurts, or slights. When I'm reacting in a hurt way, which means withdrawing, avoiding, usually through defending myself, is what I see as rejection. I must not withhold love, disassociate myself, and instead be vulnerable and suffer myself to be wounded in this relationship and practice the wound of love. And they went through that of Ken and Treya just rubbing each other in this egoic, hurting each other and blaming each other. But they got through it in a year. It might take a little longer for some. Well, of course, they were under the gun. You know, she had cancer. She was not going to be around. This was like speed course. That quality of growth that my teacher, Sasaki Roshi, as I said, has always used relationship as a... he talks about true relationship, And as he will say to us as we're up on the mountains meditating, he says, you guys, this is the easy part. This is the part where, yes, you can make a true relationship with the pine tree and the rocks. But when you go down the mountain, how are you going to make relationship to the people in your life that challenge you, that are difficult? How are you going to make relationship to the irritability that arises in your friction with your partner? So he actually saw it as a marvelous means of growth, a human relationship, a committed partnership relationship. And he was quite a matchmaker. He was always trying to get people hooked up to each other. Oh, you should. Yeah, very nice lady. You should see her. Good man, strong. You know? He's always trying to get them. And he's your teacher, and you think, oh my, he's so wise. He's really seeing, wow, this is my soulmate, you know. And so this one man who's, and these are mostly ordained monks and nuns. So this one monk had been, I think, through his third relationship. And I said, Soka, you know, the Roshi has some discrimination. How come all these girls he's hooking you up with, it's not working? And he says, oh, well, you don't understand. The Roshi is not interested in success. He's interested in growth. And I have grown. And sure enough, this fourth relationship, they're in a committed life partnership. And he truly did grow. The Roshi also talked about, he used, for me, koan practice that evolved, that was around my life, which is having a life partnership, having children, having a career, and maybe the ancient koans of Zen, you know, could appeal to some people, but he always tried to tailor it to where you were in life. And I so appreciate it. I mean, to work with the absolute in its form of my partner, my children, my dancing. Over and over again, he pointed the way, and that was practice. So that ultimately, he would say, yes, human love, very important, very important. But true love is the ultimate truth, or what he would call absolute. And so that is what he was teaching. And he, if he could help us practice this dissolving of this egoic structure, the one that, as Treya said, retracts from relationship, retracts from love. If he could help us practice the dissolving, the surrender, then he would say, yes, now you will have true relationship. And that is his practice. Then that is the practice of the the life partnership, the spiritual practice, how, for me, how they came together. Before I go to another section, I'd like to read a poem that I made up on Mount Baldy, separated from my life partner at retreat. So this is me at my ordination in 2000. I asked the Roshi if I could be ordained so that I could be of wider service when my youngest son reached 5. I had made the commitment that I would not go away again to retreat or session until I really didn't want to leave my partner and my family. Because my particular struggle was, yes, I loved being on the mountain. it was so much harder to be in partnership in the world, householder life. I really just wanted to skip right over that and be the nun on the mountaintop. So I made that commitment that I would not leave again until I really didn't want to go. As I would share with my partner, that whenever I left Mount Baldy, I would cry. And he said, oh, I always cried when I went to Mount Baldy. And my partner and I, who started this practice together, he said, you know, it's not for me. I'm withdrawing. I support you, in that lovely way of Rilke saying, I support your development. I support it so much that I will even stay home, work full time, make meals, and take care of three children while you are on retreat. So you can imagine why I have this wonderful gratitude and appreciation. So this is Valentine's Day 2006. Some of these terms are about, I'll explain a little bit. As a ordained person, you get to be helped to run the retreats. In this particular retreat, I was Densu, which is sort of the leader of the Sutra Hall, leads the chants, greets the guests, have people sign the book for the Roshi's talk, does the ceremonies, you know, gets us all set up for the ceremonies. So that was my job. And the other thing you should know, that one of my favorite of Roshi's koana is Where Has the Distance Gone?
Where has what gone?
Where has the distance gone? So, early morning on Valentine's Day, I usher a white moth out of the Sutra Hall. I think of you and the poem I wrote about our evolving love, a gift to you on another Valentine's Day. You are here, you are not here. Later that morning, as I write in the Teisho guestbook, day 7, February 14th, I put Happy Valentine's Day on the next line. I think of you and things we have done together on that psychic node, as we called it, Florence, Calistoga, or a special dinner. You are here, you are not here. After closing, it is very late. Sosan has gone on a long time, and I have ceremony preparations to do. I go from phone to phone, trying to find one that will let me through. None do. I think of you in our home, perhaps waiting for a call that never comes, as it always did at the end of session. You are here. You are not here. It is the day after. I am at the airport buying Valentine chocolates on sale. I think of you and sharing chocolate with you in your office late at night. Family life recedes. It's just the two of us again. You are here. You are not here. We are coming closer. The distance is gone. So, I'm involved in a spiritual practice that actually, in its historical form, has encouraged home leaving. You were encouraged, if the call to know the ultimate truth, the call for liberation, the call for enlightenment, meant that you left home, that you went to a monastery, that you Well, the Buddha is a great example. That left wife and child to pursue enlightenment. For me, and for maybe others who have encountered this, the Eastern or the Buddhist, yogic, Hindu idea of the spiritual search, may feel that the tug or the challenge of the yearning to follow that call, and then also perhaps the instinctual belief that being in a committed life partnership, being in household householder in the marketplace, is also a vehicle for liberation. We can add Christianity also to that, have a monastic practice, a practice where one goes apart from the world, perhaps as a life choice, to discover one's true relationship with God, or complete, or to dwell in that in a full-time basis. Other traditions, the Islamic tradition and Native American, Jewish, have never had home leaving practices in that particular way. So it's very interesting for me that here in this crossroads of 21st century America, life partnership has all these new influences and yeasty workings on what it means to enter this lifelong journey together. Life partnerships didn't used to last 67 years. That was my parents. 67 years. It's a long journey. For my father, I realized that it was clearly his spiritual practice, his devotion and commitment to my mother, who was mentally ill. And I remember my son, when they were quite old, and my mother went through some hard times. She lost all her teeth because she was on lithium. They didn't know that lithium would rot your teeth out. She was losing her hair. She looking a little worse for the wear. And my little son Damien saying, "Nana, I mean Papa, do you think Nana's pretty?" And my father just lit up and he said, "Damien, she will always be beautiful to me." And he didn't mean even just in appearance. There was something that even though she made his life hell, but he, in his devotion to this relationship and his willingness to walk through hell with her, was his spiritual practice. It was a great example for me. And I feel that perhaps that generation that felt there was their choices were different, let's put it that way. As I said, this yeasty stuff that's working on relationships today, that people are coming together in a more equal way. My mother would never have been able to support herself on her own. She didn't have an education. It was a time where women didn't work outside of the home. Nowadays, people are coming together in an equitable way. They're sharing the householder life. I remember meeting with a friend who said, "I just can't believe my sons-in-law." You know, she had three daughters. Each one of them is taking equal responsibility for this partnership. That wasn't the way with me. So we have new influences, it seems. We have new definitions of life partnerships. It doesn't need to be a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman. They're making this commitment, serious, deep commitment, and devoted commitment to walk either till death do us part, or as long as we both shall live. That's the new phrase. I'm just, as I said, wanting to, I'm again very thankful for Amma to help me bring into my awareness again what this means, what this journey means. And that if I'm also mentoring in some ways to my children, that my awareness of what is the difficulties and also the wonders of these relationships, that I can be perhaps more helpful to them when they, if and when they enter that journey together. And so what I wanted to bring out tonight is just for all of you, I hope, to just bring that into your awareness for yourself, for the young people in your life, for the older people in your life who are going through the last stages of the journey, some of them still together, supporting them. And I'm very happy to open this up to anyone or to some other viewpoints or awareness of that you can share with us. I would really appreciate that. So I think I have shared with you what my bringing my awareness to this subject is. So I would love to open it up if anyone has something they would like to share or comment or question.
Mm-hmm. One thing in the vow that you read, the traditional vow, if you remember, it originally was for the wife to love, honor, and obey. And it wasn't until Women's Lib came that women started even objecting to that. The man could love, honor, and cherish, but the woman had to love, honor, and obey. Okay. And that has been a major shift in marriage in our time. And as you say, the younger the man, the more likely he is now to share responsibilities and not, you know, well, I make the money and you do all the house things sort of mm-hmm. thing. And that's really been quite an evolution just in the last 30, 40 years, that the young people, I don't think, realize they have that freedom mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. their forebears didn't for so long. Like, young women today don't always realize the fact that they can waltz in and get a good job at a good pay, often because affirmative action is giving them a boost. Not only are they not put down, but they're often boosted up because of it. Was because of the women before them mm-hmm. that went out and got things to change. And so the whole thing with marriage, it's interesting because in the 60s and the 70s, back in the hippie era, things really began to change. Then it went into the women's consciousness raising sort of from that, and it's really transformed the whole concept of marriage. It's been a very interesting time.
You know, even the word marriage, I don't know if I've been hearing the word partnership a lot more. I was very interested even last week here at Many Rivers when a man was giving a talk that he was referring to the couples as partners.
Yes, he never did say if they were married.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought that was interesting. Yeah. Even in, I thought, well, maybe in Japan that doesn't make a difference. But yes.
But I think it's something that's coming into cultural consciousness.
Yeah.
That husband-wife has loaded terms that there's an equality about partnership. Some people, some of the languages have been in the vows, and there are definitely more modern vows, and they'll also say spouse or partner.
Right.
I don't necessarily. It was interesting for me to as you say, even the traditional vows have been changed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You read some of Rilke on marriage. I didn't hear the part where he talks about being the guardians of each other's solitude.
Mm.
And that's the part I remember best about it. And I wonder if you have anything to say on that point.
The guardians of each other's solitude. I would say, in the sense of the respect for the part, for the, well, you know, there was a wonderful saying of C.S. Lewis's wife, who died of cancer, and she said, you know, we can go only this far, and then it's alone into the alone. And what I feel like is that C.S. Lewis not only respected that and honored that, but perhaps was able to be a guardian of that, alone into the alone.
In a way, when your husband supported you by handling your householder duties so that you could go off and become a nun for a while at
mm-hmm.
least and leave
nun
that
for a
line,
week.
he was supporting your solitude
yes.
in that way. So that was a very practical way of That's a great gift, and it's a very understanding one. You know, to have a lot of understanding of what's important for you.
Mm-hmm. I hope I reciprocated.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still have that sense that you did at the beginning of coming home? How has that evolved for you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that sense of trust and faith, and yet there was a time we went through a very, very difficult time together, and I could clearly see we could cross the line, and that could be the death of the relationship. The trust could go, the sense of aha could go, and actually, it was my husband who had a dream that he was waiting for me in our bedroom, and as I came up the stairs, he was shooting at me, and I was madly dodging and diving under the bed and going into the closet. And he said when he woke up from that dream, he realized that we were perilously close to wounding the relationship to death, that it could die if we continued in this direction. It was a great wake up call. So yes, we managed to pull back and again to be a sanctuary for each other. But this life partnership, it just it can bring up those things so powerfully that if you're not conscious, we can step over that line. That's what it felt like. We could step over that line too easily. And I imagine that in many of the dissolutions of life partnership, that is what happens. Yeah?
You sort of wove together very interestingly, I thought, this theme of the way that marriage and its evolution into partnership has occurred across many cultures, really,
mm-hmm.
not just Western or American culture. And then you were tying that to this Indian notion of the stages of life with a renunciate, a forest dweller, and renunciate stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then your own experience seemed to speak of a
of a blending of those two, just in terms of the point that was made a moment ago about mm-hmm. about how your relationship actually created a space for you to at least on regular occasions mm-hmm. have this experience of feeding yourself by pulling back from the ordinary responsibilities of life. And so I'm wondering if it feels as if that's a way to think about how to, or if you'd comment on whether that's a way to think about how people can support each other in spiritual practice in this culture where mostly we're not going to go out with a begging bowl and support our spiritual practices that way.
It turns out that my spiritual practice has this form of going to the mountain to be with a teacher in silence. Mm-hmm. I imagine not everyone's practice is like that.
Right.
But that ability to support and be a guardian for your partner's search for oneness, for all that is, it seems a very important part of that journey. What's interesting for me then is also to look at this renunciant stage. I think I had some idea that, well, geez, someday I'm going to be able to go to the monastery full time, and that's what happened usually, like in the East. You know, you got to go when you were done with householder life. You could become a renunciate. And householder life may have ended a little earlier because people didn't live so long. And suddenly I had this realization, wow, we may be in life partnership into our 90s. There's not going to necessarily be a time when leaves the partner to go to the monastery. So this way of supporting each other and continuing the search for liberation is going to have to take into account that old age, sickness, and death together until one of us leaves. And that was a little bit of a shock. I think I always had some, must have been from a former lifetime, some idea that I was going to get back to the mountain full time. And suddenly I realized, no, that may not happen. And I just want to bring one interesting thing is we also have this amazing experience of couples now living at spiritual centers into their old age. My son, who's been sitting at San Francisco Zen Center, he says it's he loves seeing Blanche and Lou Hartman around because Lou, I mean, they're in their 80s or 90s, and Lou moves very slowly, and Blanche is right by his side, you know, walking him or helping him, and yet they're in a spiritual practice center where, you know, meditation is available two or three times a day, and the chanting services, and it's there, and they're practicing, in a sense, renunciant practice together at a center. So this is new. I mean, men and women weren't even allowed to practice together in monasteries and convents. So this is an evolution. It seems to be happening quite rapidly. Did you, Lois?
I just wanted to add a little clarification about the Hindu four stages of life, mm-hmm. which might bring some light to what you're seeing. The first stage was the student stage, where you were living in the house of your teacher, often your spiritual teacher. And then when you left, you were given a flame that you were to bring to your new householder life. And as a householder, you would... Your main religious duty was to tend that fire, so that you had a reminder of the spiritual fire in your householder life the whole time you were there. Then you became a forest dweller when your children were old enough to be taking care of themselves, so you kind of lived outside the city. However, the renunciant stage was that the two of you then wandered. So it was a sannyas stage, not that you went into a monastery, but you gave up the sense of a permanent home. You renounced your possessions, and you both wandered together on the search for God. So the idea that you would stay together throughout it wasn't that you left each other, but that you were still together, but you had renounced your worldly ties completely.
What's the difference between a forest dweller and a renunciate?
But in the forest dweller, you have a home, but it's out in the country, yeah. You know? Like, you move out of the city, okay. You've got your little home, and your grandchildren will come and visit.
Oh, okay.
You have kind of a nice laid-back life.
It's green.
As a Texas person. But then in the...
You're getting closer to nature again.
Yeah. But the renunciate stage, you've actually given that up. And you become wandering monks, so to speak.
It must be hard when someone's very old to wander.
Yeah.
Maybe you just wander the corridors of the San Francisco Zen Center.
And also, they didn't live that long. So
right.
We're not talking about 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. We're talking like 50s, 60s.
That's old. I beg your pardon.
Anyway, that would be helpful. Thank you.
I love that idea of keeping the flame of the spiritual practice and search in your household life.
If your spiritual practice wasn't as strong as it is, do you think your relationship with your partner still be the same?
Definitely not.
That's clear.
No, I definitely feel like that my own issues and unskillful behavior and egoic challenges would have probably unraveled the relationship, and it was particularly my being able it through the practice to look at that and surrender.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe that has something to do with you know, as women are more hormonal, mm-hmm. and then men are more a little more steady. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the majority,
right?
Or the people that is close to me. That's how I see it. So it seems like we need more support in that sense than mm-hmm. men. Mm-hmm. But of course, it always depends on the person. But just because of the And I remember being young, how I was always up and down, and then I finally relaxed. So no wonder none of my marriages worked.
Well, personally, I think menopause was the big challenge.
I'm curious as to the length and frequency of retreats in your practice.
Usually they're 7-day retreats, and then they're 3-month training periods. I was never able to do a full 3-month training period between career and work and a partnership. That didn't seem, I could do like a couple of weeks. So over all these years, I would commit to do 2 7-day sessions at least. Year until that time, until then with children, I had to wait till they were old enough. Sometimes I didn't wait till they were old enough, unfortunately. There was this horrible moment when I had left my middle son when he was 1.5 years, and he did not recognize me when I came home. Oh. Took him a few hours, and that was a big wake up call. So, yes, we learn by our unskillfulness. I love the Buddhist terms of skillful and unskillful. I just think, let's get rid of this good and bad stuff. And especially in this mirroring that we're doing with our partner, you know, boy, that was really unskillful of you.
I thought that was very unskillful of you to call that to my attention.
I still think it helps a little bit. And even just tonight, just as we were coming here tonight, my husband is a wonderful amateur musician. And, you know, for years and years and years, it just irritated the hell out of me as he would pick up the flute or the whatever he was, especially when we had to leave on time. And over and over again, you know, I just could not get through that. And tonight, I went, oh, aren't I lucky to have this beautiful music in my house? That was the first time I could really, really appreciate that, because I had been putting my attention, is this life partnership really my spiritual practice? If it is, I've got to bring all these elements into it. I can't leave any of it out. And it's a great wake-up call. And then one of my friends said, oh yeah, we've been married for 44 years, I said, or we've been together for 44 years, she said. Have you come to know him yet? No, he's always changing. And that delight, too, that we get to grow together. I did want to share one thing. You know, these young people, they've got something going. You know, even though all these ideas over romantic love and pressure. My son was in a musical called The Wedding Singer. And one of the lines is, and it was written by young people. One of the lines is, so how did you know he was right for you? And she said, well, he was the only one I could imagine growing old with. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's a little different take of, you know, back when I was young, we had the Beatles singing, will you still love me? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Because we thought everyone, you know, just liquidated after age 30. You know, 64, oh my gosh. And this sort of tongue-in-cheek, ironic, you know, you're really going to, you know, like me when I'm 64. And so in this Wedding Singer, and my son who's playing the Wedding Singer, he gets to sing this song to this lady about how he'll do the dishes, he'll rub her feet and do the dishes in your kitchen sink and put you to bed when you've had too much to drink, and I want to grow old with you. And I thought, wow, these young people are really getting smart. They're examining what is this romantic love. So I have great hopes for our young people, even with all these incredible pressures on the relationship.
Jenny,
mm-hmm.
I just have to say a word of appreciation to the steady, quiet support of your husband here tonight.
And this is us in Europe, in England. We call it BC, you know, before children. And then this is us much more recently. There's a lot of winds passing through us here. We're a little more together. took a 44 years of walking.
My sense has always been that it's the vision that we share that choreographs relationship, and through relationship, vision gets its opportunity to surface, to show itself. And so, what does shared vision mean to you? to you in terms of relationship?
Well, it certainly it's a dance because, you know, one person's leading for a while and the other person is saying, okay, I trust, I'll go along. I will accept your vision till it becomes mine. And I will commit to that. I will commit that we can't go off on two roads. We're still on this road. I might be, you know, further, not quite side by side, you know. Sometimes it seems to me, the times you actually are walking really side by side are a little rarer. Sometimes someone's ahead saying, come on. Trust me, I think this is where we need to go. Or sometimes the other person says, no. I love the Rilke idea of a dance, because, I mean, I guess traditionally the male leads, but not in my dancing. It's a partnership, and we keep changing. And we do have to, then there comes a time where you do have to say, this is our vision of together. We, you know, whether it's buying a house, having children, getting a new dog. But one person is usually like, come on. Well, I really appreciated your coming together to look at this together. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was truly wonderful. Thank you so much. Really. And kudos to Amba for stimulating it. But I also
being
have
forceful.
Exactly. Forceful in the way she knows how to do. And that goes on the tape, too. Don't delete that. So, a couple of things. I want to point out to you that our speaker tonight is featured in one of the chapters of this book, The Unknown She, which we have.
Which is what?
The Unknown She, Eight Faces of an Emerging Consciousness by Hilary Hart. Ginny is featured in one of the chapters in this book. We have a few other books on relationship as well here. We also have a donation bowl over on the counter, and we share that with our speakers to allow them to support their work, and so that we can support the maintenance and future use of this space for events like this once again. So thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you to our speaker again. And have a wonderful night.
Thank you.
Thank you.